What do you mean to do with them? How do I know? I am asking you for advice and counsel just because I don't know what to do. You, my steward, whom I took into this story for you to give me of your steadiness when I get excited. You can afford to give me some, for you've got too much. You are far too phlegmatic. You just stand there and raise your eyebrows and put your lips together. And just because you are like that, you do not have any ideas. But we need ideas. We owe it to the kind of story it is. For the meeting of the act and the result is a feast of no common sort. It must be celebrated and adorned with all sorts of solemn flourishes and pious maneuvers, so that the world will have to laugh and cry over it 5,000 years and more. Excitement and fear are less productive than peace and quiet, Adon. I will mix you a soothing drink now. I will shake a powder into water, and it will sink and be still. But if I shake another kind into the cup, then the two will seethe up together, and if you drink it foaming, it will act as a sedative. I will gladly drink it later, Mai, at the right moment, when I need it most. Now, hearken to what I have done so far. I have sent running messengers with orders to segregate them from the other travelers, and not to give them corn in the border cities, but to send them on to Menfe, to the head office. I have arranged to have an eye kept on them, so that they are sent to good rest-houses with their animals, and are cared for without their knowing it in the strange land, as new and strange to them as it was to me when I died up above there and was brought down here at 17 years old. I was flexible then, but they, I realize, are all getting to the end of the 40s, except Benjamin, and he is not with them, and all I know is that he must be fetched, in the first place so I can see him, and in the second place, because if he is here, the father will come too. In short, I have laid upon our people to make smooth the way under their feet, so that they strike not against a stone, if the figure means anything to you. And they shall be brought before me in the ministry, in the hall of audience. Not in your house? No, not yet. At first, quite formally, at the office. Between you and me, the hall there is much bigger and more impressive. And what will you do with them there? Yes, of course. That will be the moment for me to drink your foaming draught, because I have not the least idea in the world what I shall do when they do not know me, nor what when I tell them who I am. But one thing I do know, I will not be so clumsy as to spoil the beautiful story and burst out headlong with the climax like an inexperienced storyteller. No, I will sit tight when they come in and treat them like strangers. You mean you will be unfriendly? I mean formal to the point of unfriendliness. For I think, Mai, I shall hardly succeed in being strange unless I force myself to be unfriendly. That will be easier. I must think of some reason why I have to speak harshly and can go at them properly. I must act as though their case was suspicious, and strict investigations had to be made, and all the circumstances cleared up, whether or no. Will you speak with them in their tongue? That is the first useful word your stolidity has managed to utter, cried Joseph, striking his brow. I certainly needed to be reminded of that, for the fact is I am always speaking Canaanitish with them in my mind, like the fool that I am. How should I come to know Canaanitish? That would be a frightful faux pas. I do speak it with the children. I suppose I am giving them an Egyptian accent. Well, that is the least of my troubles. I seem to be talking at random, saying things that might be important under less exciting circumstances, but not now. Of course, I cannot know any Canaanitish. I must speak through an interpreter. We must have one here. I will give orders in the ministry. A good one, who knows both languages about equally, so that he can render what I say exactly, without making it any weaker or stronger. For what they say themselves, for instance, Big Reuben. Oh, Reuben, my God! He was at the empty pit to save me. I know it from the watchman. I don't know if I told you about that. Sometime I will. What they say themselves, of course, I shall understand. But I must not show that I do, or forget and answer what they say before the long-winded interpreter is translated. When you have taken it in, Adon, you will do it all right. and then perhaps you might pretend you take them for scouts, come to spy out the weakness of the land. I beg of you, my, spare me your ideas. How do you come to make big eyes and suggest things to me?
I thought I was supposed to, my lord. I thought so at first myself, my friend. But I see, after all, that nobody can or should advise me in this most solemn business. I must shape its course all by myself.
Remember how you are using your ingenuity in the story of the three love affairs to make it as exciting and delightful as possible, and let me use mine on my own. Who told you I had not got the idea of pretending I took them for spies?
So we both have the same idea.
Of course, because it is the only right one, and as good as written down already. In fact, this whole story is written down already in God's book, my, and we shall read it together between laughing and tears. For you will be there, won't you, and come to the office when they are here, tomorrow or day after, and are brought into the great hall of the Nourisher, with himself painted over and over on the walls? Of course you will be among my train. I must have a stately retinue when I receive them.
Oh, my!
He burst out, and buried his face in his hands, those hands at which the little urchin Benoni had looked in the grove of the Lord Adon as they wove the myrtle garland. Now one of them wore Pharaoh's sky-blue lapis-lazuli ring inscribed, Be as myself.
I shall see them, my own folk, my own, for they were always that, however much we quarreled through the fault of all of us. I shall speak with them, Jacob's sons, my brothers, to whom I have kept so long the silence of death, and learn whether he can still hear that I am alive, and that God accepted the beast instead of the son. I shall hear everything. I shall learn all that has happened, how Benjamin lives, and whether they treat him brotherly. And I must get him down here. And my father, too. Oh, my taskmaster, now my housemaster, it is all too exciting and solemn for words. And just because it is so solemn, it must be treated with a light touch. For lightness, my friend, flippancy, the artful jest, that is God's very best gift to man. The profoundest knowledge we have of that complex, questionable thing we call life. God gave it to humanity that life's terribly serious face might be forced to wear a smile. My brothers rent my garment and flung me into the pit. Now they're to stand before my stool. And that is life. And the question whether we are to judge the act by the result and approve the bad act because it was needed for the good result, that is life, too. Life puts such questions as these, and they cannot be answered with a long face. Only in lightness can the spirit of man rise above them. With a laugh at being faced with the unanswerable, perhaps he can make even God himself, the great unanswering, to laugh. The audience. Joseph was indeed as Pharaoh when he sat in his seat on his raised dais in the hall of the Nourisher, beneath white ostrich feather fans thrust into chaste gold shields, held above him by pages in aprons with bobbed hair. About him were his chief scribes from the ministry, an austere group of magistrates. Along the dais to right and left, lance-bearers of his household guard stood in a row. Two double lines of orange columns covered with ornamental inscriptions on white bases, with green lotus capitals and overpieces in colored enamel, ran from his dais to the farthest entrance doors, and on the long and high side walls above the dado, Hapi the Overflowing was repeatedly pictured. In human form, with covered sex, one breast male, the other female, the royal beard on his chin, reeds on his head, bearing on his palms the presentation tray with wild jungle flowers and slender water jugs. Between these repeated representations of the god came other forms of life in flowing lines and bright colors, gleaming in the rays of light that fell through the stone gratings of the high windows. There were scenes of sowing and threshing. Pharaoh himself plowed with oxen and cut the first swath with the sickle into the golden grain. There were the seven kine of Osiris, with the bull whose name he knew, pacing in a row with exquisite inscriptions such as, Oh, may the Nile give me food and nourishment, and every green thing according to its time. Such was the hall of audience,
where every cry for bread came before the vice Horus, for he reserved to himself each decision. Here now he sat, on the third day after his talk with his steward. My Sakme now stood behind his seat, and had actually mingled him a foaming draught. And Joseph had just dismissed a pig-tailed and bearded delegation, wearing shoes turned up at the toes, from the land of the great king Mushili, in other words, Hatti, where, too, famine reigned. He had been absent-minded and heedless, as everyone had remarked, for he had dictated to his actual scribe a figure of more wheat, spelt, rice, and millet, and at a lower price than the delegates from Hatti had themselves offered. Some of those present thought there might be diplomatic reasons for this. Perhaps, who knew, the moment had come in the world political sphere to show King Mushili some attention. Others ascribed it to the physical condition of the universal friend, as he had remarked before the sitting that he had a catarrh from the dust, and he kept a handkerchief before his mouth. Above the handkerchief, his eyes looked out into the great hall when the men from Hatti had left, and the group of Asiatics were brought in their turn. One of their number was tall like a tower. Another had a melancholy, leonine head. One was solid and marrowy. Another had long, nimble legs. Two others did not dissemble their natively belligerent air. One kept giving piercing glances round about him. Another was striking because of his very bony joints, and still another because his eyes and lips were so bright and humid. One had curly hair, a round beard, and much red and blue dye of the purple snail about his garment. Each, in short, had something to distinguish him. In the middle of the hall they found it good to fall on their faces, and the universal friend had to wait till they stood up again to beckon them near him with his fan. They came closer, and then again fell on their faces. "So many?" he asked in a muffled voice, which, oddly enough, he had pitched almost in a growl. 10 all at once? Why not 11? Interpreter, ask them why there are not 11 of them, or even 12. Or do you men understand Egyptian? Not so well as we should like to, O Lord, our refuge, answered one of them in his own tongue. It was he on the runner's legs, whose tongue, it seemed, was nimble too. You are as Pharaoh, you are as the moon, the merciful father, who comes forth in majestic garment. You are as a first-born steer in his adornment, Moshel, ruler. Our hearts praise with one voice him who here holds market, nourisher of the lands, food of the world, without whom no one has breath, and we wish for you as many years of life as the year has days. But your tongue, O Adon, we understand not enough to deal with you. Be merciful unto us. You are as Pharaoh, they all repeated in chorus. While the interpreter rapidly and monotonously translated Naphtali's words, Joseph devoured with his eyes the men standing before him. He knew them every one, and had no trouble in marking in each the work the hand of time had done upon them too. O God of dispensations, they were all there. The hate-hungry wolf-pack that had flung itself on him with cries of, "Down with him! Down with him!" How he had begged, "Do not tear it! Do not tear it!" But all the furious pack had dragged him to the pit with shoutings and hallooings, the while he questioned the heavens in a daze, "What is this that has come upon me?" They had sold him as a criminal to the Ishmaelites for 20 silver pieces, and before his eyes had dabbled the ruins of his garment in blood. Here they were now, his brothers in Jacob, come out of long-ago time, his murderers because of dreams, led to him by dreams, and the whole past was like one dream. There were the red-eyed ones, all 6 of them, and the 4 of the maids, Bilhah's adder and snake and her prattler of news, Zilpah's sturdy eldest in his tunic, the forthright Gad, and his brother, the sweet tooth. He was one of the youngest, next to Issachar, the beast of burden, and the tarry Zebulun, and he had wrinkles already, and lines in his face, and much silver in his beard, and his smooth, oiled hair. Good God, how old they had got! It was very moving, as all life is moving, but he shrank back at sight of them, for with them so old, it was unbelievable that the father was still alive. With his heart full of laughing and weeping and dismay, he looked at them, recognized every single one despite the beards, which some of them in his time had not yet worn. But they, looking at him in their turn, had no such thoughts, for their seeing eyes were wrapped in blindness against the possibility that it could be he. They had once sold a blood brother and shameless brat away into the world, out into far horizons and misty distances. That they never ceased to know. They knew it now. But that the aristocratic heathen there in his throned chair under the feather fans, in brilliant white that blazed against the perfectly Egyptian brownness of his brow and arms, that the potentate and provider here to whom they had come in their need, he who had about his neck the collar of favor, an amazing piece of goldsmith's work, and an equally marvelous breastpiece with falcons, sun-beetles, and life-crosses arranged with the utmost art, that he there, under the waving fly-fans, the silver ceremonial hatchet in his belt, his headcloth wound in the manner of the country, with stiff lappets falling on the shoulders, that this could be the one-time outcast, mourned by the father till he mourned himself out, the dreamer of dreams, to such a thought they were immune. They were shut and bolted against it. Besides, the man kept his handkerchief to his face all the time, and made even the barely possible impossible. He spoke again, and every time, directly he paused, the interpreter beside him rattled off what he had said in monotonous Canaanitish. "Whether there can be any dealing here at all, or any delivery of grain," he said crossly, "is still a question. We must consider it. It may easily turn out otherwise. That you do not speak the language of men is the least of your troubles. I pity you if you thought you could hold speech in your jargon with Pharaoh's first mouthpiece. A man like me speaks the tongue of Babylon and Kittitish, but he can hardly let himself in for Kabirish and such like gibberish. And if he had ever known it, he would make haste to forget it." Pause for translation. "You look at me," he went on, not waiting for an answer. "You stare at me like men without culture, and take private note that I keep a handkerchief before my face, from which you conclude that I am not feeling well. Well, I am not. What is there in that to remark and take down and draw conclusions from? I have a catarrh from the dust. Even a man like me can suffer from catarrh. My physicians will cure me. Medical science is far advanced in Egypt. My own house steward, the overseer of my private palace, is a physician himself, so you see he will treat me. But people, however remote from me, who had to undertake a journey, and furthermore a journey through desert lands, under these abnormal and unfavorable meteorological conditions, have my sincere sympathy. I feel keenly what they must have had to endure on the journey. Whence do you come?"
"From Hebron, great Adon, from Kirjath Arba, the four-square town, and from the terebinths of Mamre in the land of Canaan, to buy food in Egypt. We are all..."
"Stop. Who is that speaking? Who is the little man with the shining lips? Why is it he speaks? Why not that tall tower over there? He is built like one, at least. He seems to be the oldest and most intelligent amongst your crew."
"It is Asher, by your favor. Asher, so is your servant's name, a brother among brothers, for we are all brothers and sons of one man in the bond of brotherhood. And when a thing concerns all of us, it is Asher, your humble servant, who is accustomed to take the word."
"Oh, so you are the common mouth for commonplaces. Good. But now I come to look at you all, it does not escape my penetration that although you are supposed to be brothers, you are very different among yourselves, some belonging in one group and some in another. This common mouth here looks like the man over there in a short coat with bits of bronze sewed on it. The one beyond, with eyes like a snake, has something or other in common with the man next him, standing first on one leg and then on the other. But several of you seem to belong together by virtue of the red eyes you have in common."
It was Reuben who took upon himself to reply. "Verily, you see all, Lord," Joseph heard him say. "Likenesses and differences are due to our being from different mothers, four from two, and six from one. But we are one man's sons,
Jacob, your servant, who begot us and who sent us to you to buy bread.
He sent you to me, repeated Joseph, and lifted the handkerchief until it almost covered his whole face. He looked at them over it. Man, you surprise me by the thinness of your voice, coming from such a tower of a body. But I am still more surprised at your words. Time has silvered all your hair and beards, and the eldest of you, who has no beard, has more silver hair to make up for it. Your looks contradict your words, for you do not look like people whose father is still alive. By your favor, he lives, O Lord. Judah took up the tale. Let me bear witness to my brother's words. We deal in truth. Our father, your servant, lives in his state. And really, he is not so old after all, maybe 80 or 90, which is not unusual in our stock. For our ancestor was 100 years old when he begot the true and right son, our father's father.
How uncivilized, said Joseph, his voice breaking.
He turned round to his steward, then back, and for a while said nothing, to the unease of his audience.